You are listening to Hussein Ibish, a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Dr. Ibish, we're talking about wide-scale changes. Are they even possible? This involves a lot of deeply entrenched people and sectors.
I think it depends on what country. I don't think we can lump them all in together by any means. A country like Algeria could embark on a process of evolutionary change if the elite decides to try to manage change in an acceptable way. That could happen. I think it's really difficult to imagine it happening in Iraq or Lebanon. In Iraq, the presence of Iran really sort of puts the brakes on all of this and makes it very hard to move forward. In Lebanon, I think what you're looking at is a situation where there is only one route for possible long-term change, which is that the old idea of Lebanon as a modern sort of unified political project, an identity that could grow within the context of statehood, even if you begin by making a state from this weird conglomeration of all these different constituencies that are very conscious of their own specific differences, and everything begins by being apportioned and gerrymandered and all that. The idea originally of Lebanon from the 40s and 50s was that it would grow into an e pluribus unum, a whole greater than the sum of its parts, or a whole out of many one kind of thing. And I think that idea was presumed to be dead and buried after the Civil War and then the tense period of coexistence since the end of the war in 1990. I think with the protesters on the ground, what you see is that in the popular consciousness, that goal, that ideal, has never fully died. And so in the Lebanese case, it's conceivable that over a very long period of time, that ideal could reassert itself. But it's hard to know how you would translate it into political gains, because in both Iraq and Lebanon, the sectarian blob that exists just devours everything in its path, and it's quite likely in the end that any momentum or gains that the protesters achieve will just be swallowed up by the blob. So, you know, if you have jobs, the blob eventually takes them, and it becomes patronage. If you have, more services, somehow it'll benefit parts of the blob, and it's hard to get around that.
Final question. Tunisia is often pointed out as the sole country to undergo the Arab Spring and actually come out a democracy. But that democracy we see now is deeply divided to the point of paralysis. Yeah. Do you think this is lost on the protesters in Iraq and Lebanon?
In Tunisia, you've had several changes of government, difficult negotiations over a contentious constitution, a transformation, purported transformation of a Nahda from an Islamist to a kind of a conservative religious party, which is different. And, I think there's, in spite of the paralysis in Tunisia, in spite of the myriad problems there, it's still relatively a success story. But I don't think people in Lebanon or Iraq, in Algeria, protesters may be considering Tunisia as a potential kind of inspirational model. I don't think that's true in Lebanon and Iraq. I think in Lebanon and Iraq, people are very focused on the granular problems of their day-to-day lives. And what they want is a better government, more responsive to their concerns, less kleptocratic, less corrupt. What they discover quickly, as I was saying, is that what they're talking about then is not just a set of policies or a set of realities, but a political system that is incapable of changing them or adjusting them or reforming in any serious way. And then at that point, the whole thing becomes inevitably political and totalizing, and a vast rejection of everyone, and sort of revolutionary. It's revolutionary without a clear political leadership and without a unified set of demands other than they go out. So let's say, for example, elites were pushed out in either of those countries. It's not really possible to do that en masse, but let's say there was some kind of a situation like that. Who would come in? There's no agreement on that. What would take over? So in a certain sense, what people are calling for is a transition that would involve a kind of a vacuum or at least a transfer from one wielder of power to another set of wielders of power without having a clear alternative in mind. And that makes it very, very hard. And that's why I think in the end, the only hope, I don't know what the hope is in Iraq, frankly. It's very hard. I mean, you're probably a negotiation between the people and the Shiite authorities. And all of this is happening only in Shiite areas of Iraq. It's not happening in Sunni majority areas. It's not happening in the Kurdish areas. It's really Shiite protesters condemning Shiite leaders. They might be able to have some kind of a negotiation in Lebanon. I think in the long run, popular demand to move beyond the confessional system where everything is based on religion and community, and trying to implement law, you know, parts of the Constitution that are there about creating a post-confessional, post-sectarian Lebanon. They haven't been enforced. I suppose it could start to happen if you had, you know, the Constitution calls for a bicameral legislature, one house of which would be entirely kind of democratic and not gerrymandered on the basis of community. If you could end up getting that, that would certainly be a start. In the end, if Lebanese are going to hold on to that vision and really cherish it, they'll find a way to get it done. But it's going to compete against a tremendous amount of corrupt pressure with a great deal of leverage. And in the end, the willingness of Hezbollah, I think, and its allies, but especially Hezbollah, to use force to preserve this system that allows them to do what they want to do.
Hussein Ibish, thank you for joining me at the Media Line. I'm Lawrence Rifkin.